Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started. So I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians, the music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. Interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations, postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. Production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.
Hi, this is Towers, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC. Diverse, independent, yours.
Hello, and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon, and joining me, as usual, is Hale. And today we have a very special guest joining us, Sebastian Purcell. He's an associate professor of philosophy at the State University of New York at Courtville. He's also the author of The Path of Wisdom, The Wisdom of the Aztecs, and he's also the translator of The Discourses of the Elders, the Aztec Huehuetlatoli. How did you get into studying this?
My grandmother spoke to us in Nahuatl as children, but we really kind of disregarded that. And so my maternal grandmother, my mother's from Mexico. I didn't know about Aztec philosophy. I went through graduate school. I completed all my coursework. I wrote my dissertation. I had done everything but defend. And I took a one-year like visiting assistant professor position at a local university there in Boston. This was at Norton in Boston, notably, and they wanted me to teach a class on Latin American philosophy. So this was, I agreed, and the summer before I was working out the syllabus for it, and I thought I would do Latin American philosophy in three segments. Something on the pre-Columbian stuff, which I figured would be like, I don't know, interpreting dances or something like that. The colonial era items, which is, you know, a mix of Spanish and Latin. I felt well acquainted with that. And then something closer to the contemporary, like the 20th century era, that is sort of post. A lot of that was influenced by continental philosophy. So I thought I had a pretty good access into that. While I was researching that, I stumbled across a book in the library entitled La Filosofía Nahuatl by Miguel León Portilla. The Aztecs, also known as the Nahuas because they spoke Nahuatl. He had this book about it, and I read through it. I got lost for about a week just reading through this whole thing. It was fascinating to me. And at that point, I thought, oh, well, I'll learn one more dead language. You know, just add it to the pile of Greek and Latin and all the other stuff. And that's what I did. So I began to do that. My first primer I got was by one by Michel Darnay. So I was learning Nahuatl in French, which is weird because French is about my third language. And so it was a more arduous task than it might have been otherwise. But, yeah, so I did that. I got some, you know, the basics when I taught the class, and I thought I would write on it, maybe research some basic papers after I got tenure, which is exactly what I did. It gave me about 7 years, actually, to work on my tenure, publish on just regular ethics and, you know, logic, the things that philosophers get tenure on. And after I got it, I began to write on it. So I found it fascinating from personal, like a personal standpoint, but I stumbled into it by literally finding a book in a library next to other stuff that I was looking for. Complete happenstance.
That seems to be the way it goes, is encountering a text, a book that opens up a whole new world for you in order to sort of move into. That was one of the things that I was sort of curious about as far as Mesoamerican philosophy is the sources that we have. Usually in philosophy we have texts, but it occurred to me to wonder whether texts are the primary form, because you mentioned too, you know, interpretive dances or something like that. I know that from sort of studying like media theory and whatnot, there is a big distinction between like texts and orality, that there's like some philosophy is transmitted orally. It's not all textual. So my I was wondering, what do the primary sources of Mesoamerican or Aztec philosophy look like?
And my answer to that is there are more sources than what I look at. Having been trained in, you know, classical Greek and Roman philosophy, basically I was trained in, you know, Catholic tradition. So Greco-Roman philosophy, logic, ethics, that was me. I just took the standards of that field and applied them to the existing texts that we do have. Now, there are some ideographic texts known as codices. Ideograms are like hieroglyphics, right? And those exist. They are difficult to interpret, even by world-class specialists. It's almost like that's the only thing you're doing in your life now, is devoting yourself to interpreting these things. There are only 9 of them, and it didn't seem to me that I was going to get very much out of those. So we do have them, 9 that are in at least the pre-conquest tradition. They exist. They're kind of cool. I understand the basics. I don't claim to be an expert, and so I ignore them. Mostly I focus on what is called stage 2 Nahuatl. What happened is that a lot of Franciscans at the time, because this would have been even before the Jesuit order, went around and transcribed the language into Latin letters and wrote a bunch of things down. And then they conducted what we would call ethnographic research. Their goal was to convert the indigenous populations. So the idea was they needed to understand what their views were in order to conduct them more or convert them more effectively. And so they went around all of the major cities asking the Tlamatinimech, I translate that as philosophers, what exactly you hold. And they asked them beliefs about everything. And they wrote those down. So one team did this, led by Sahagún, who would have been the principal investigator. He took him 30 years to do that, to compile 12 volumes. There was an earlier source compiled by Olmos, kind of a similar process, much smaller scale. We have a few of these texts that basically were compiled in that method, written down in Latin letters, and that's what I look at. These stage 2 texts, stage 1 Nahuatl would have been pre-conquest Nahuatl, or we almost have nothing that is written down in this format that would be philosophically interesting. There may be one piece that Malinche, we know she was the translator. Because when Cortez, did the whole thing, he had to negotiate via somebody, some indigenous party, right? And the woman was Malinche who did this. And so she would have been in the background. That discussion was between early Christian fathers and Nahuatlamatinime. That happened. That might be a text, but it's not preserved in the same way. So I look at these texts that borrow some nouns. They have nouns that are Spanish nouns, so you'll read in them like Dios or things like that. But they are then put into the grammar of Nahuatl. So the grammar stays intact. And that goes all the way through about 1640. After that, there's a fundamental shift in the language, becomes stage 3 Nahuatl. The grammar changes, and for philosophers, that matters, right? Terms like being do emerge in that language. They don't in the prior version, and so I just look at texts that we have recorded in that period, roughly between 1540 and 1640. It's about a century. And I exclude the codices because I don't really know how to interpret those. I exclude dances because I don't know how to interpret those. I do look at contemporary social scientific evidence for evidence that the thing that I'm looking at can be corroborated today. So one of my key claims is that the Nahuas were held a virtuethical view that was more socially centered than Aristotle. And it's helpful to have contemporary social scientific evidence that shows in kind of real detailed way how Mexican heritage children or Guatemalan heritage children are more social than their European peers. So there's a team led by Barbara Rogoff. And what she's done is they'll have tasks where they ask the children to collaborate, like European heritage children or these Mesoamerican heritage children, to collaborate on like navigating a little figure through a grocery store or things like that. And yeah, and the kids do it spontaneously. There's this thing called fluid synchrony where they start just cooperating without asking each other stuff. And that show that happens at twice the rate of these children as their European pairs. So they also disagree a lot less. And they run pace graphs on this so you can document it. So a fluid synchrony is a difference. They are collaborative. It is real. And so I'll reach for evidence like that to show like the thing that I'm reading isn't just like me reading something into it. There's contemporary survival. So I use contemporary stuff to double check things, but I don't, for example, draw on the practices of contemporary indigenous or Nahuatl speaking people, like what they're doing. I don't look at what they're doing anymore. You could, and some people do, but I don't because I want to hold back on just like my specific period. So I'm reading books. I'm reading books in Nahuatl, which is why I learned the language. And if you like learning languages, I would say, it's about as hard as learning Latin. It's not like Greek hard. So for the linguistically inclined, that's what I would recommend for that. So fun language too, because it doesn't technically even have words.
One question that I have is, how do you account for, when you're looking at these older texts, how do you account for the colonial interpretive aspect that happened as they were trying to interpret this Mesoamerican culture in this like 1540 to 1640 period? Because as you said, they obviously had other motivations in creating those works.
Yeah, and loan words and all kinds of things like that. There's two pieces here, and as the discussion has continued among scholars, I've decided to separate them very cleanly because I caused some confusion. It's an emerging field. My bad. All right. Claim number one, I'm going to just look at the philosophy that emerged in these books and treat it on its own right as worth doing. Just full stop. If it's a mix of things, if it turns out to be, you know, inflected by some sort of Christianity and what we're looking at is a syncretic philosophical production, fine. That's not what makes it philosophically interesting anyway. The thing that makes it philosophically interesting is whether or not it interacts with a set of questions that we value as philosophical and it does something for our discussion. Not provenance was never a reason to pay attention to something as a philosopher, right? So I do that. Now, can we probably distinguish some of this stuff from prior items? And the answer is yes, I think we can, but I want to treat that as a separate task at this point. In my translation, the preface to my translation, I compare that to, because various passages in that, some of them are like peeling a banana. You can very clearly see this part is the Spanish culture and this part is the indigenous stuff. And right, so... for example, the latter portions of that read exactly like my Catholic catechism classes. They just happen to be in Nahuatl, but that's all they are. They're almost biblical exegesis. Great. The earlier portions of that are different, though, and that's more like peeling a raspberry. You're going to need like a razor blade to do that, and it's going to be hard. The razor blade that I would use in most cases, at least for ethical purposes, is something along the lines of intrinsic considerations. So when you get moral admonitions that say, do this because you'll burn in hell, that sounds like a Christian set of reasons, right? Versus do this, otherwise you won't even be a human anymore. That sounds to me like an indigenous thing. That's a constitutive reason. It's intrinsic. It's not an extrinsic motivation. And that's sort of how I would divide a lot of that work. Could it be done more thoroughly? Sure. I'm not doing it right now. I just translated. I even went with my the thing that I translated is an artifact, right? It's a historical colonial artifact. And I could have synthesized it with other pieces at the time, and I didn't. I wanted to just treat it on its own because that is a legit thing, right? The critical edition that emerges from synthesizing from relevant other sources and double checking things and blah, blah, blah. That critical edition is a contemporary artifact. which may also be useful to the field, but nobody had translated this book in 500 years into English. So I thought, maybe let me just do that. Like, let's just start out by treating the one thing all on its own, no reference to anything else. And that's kind of how I treat the philosophy itself. I think it's worthwhile if it answers or addresses philosophical questions that we find interesting. And that's the only justification we need. I guess there is a lingering worry, like as in, well, why would you call it Mesoamerican then? But I think it's pretty clear that the resulting philosophy is not going to be contemporary scholasticism at the time. Right? Like you can just compare to scholasticism of the era and be like, yeah, it's very different. So at the very least, it's a syncretic production that is worth treating on its own.
Within Mesoamerican culture, like as you've been able to interpret through, you know, the works and stuff that you're looking at, what kind of distinction is there between philosophy and theology or you know, religion or like, you know, mythology or whatever it might have been, right? Like, because certain cultures obviously historically have had more of a distinction and others have not. And so it's kind of interesting to hear like what the connection was or how they even thought about those two processes of thinking.
I don't think that they're clearly distinguished, right? Just as, you know, if you read Heraclitus or Parmenides, they couch their language as if they're quasi-religious, right? Or you look at Socrates, who thought of himself as having like a relationship to the divine. I think it's going to be impossible to distinguish those clearly in that sense. Do they have philosophical moments, things that tend to turn not? Yes. Right. So, you know, their conception of the good life is about, you know, leading a more rooted life here on earth. It has no reference to the afterlife and has really nothing to do with, as far as I can say, like, okay, it really gets sticky. Like, what do you call religious? One view of the religious could be like, this is not my take. I'm going to disavow this. I'm going to formulate it as the wrong thing. Okay. But it's a clear foil. Let's say that religious thinking is propositions that the truth or falsity of which cannot be given in principle, a priori cannot be verified, that, and call those beliefs in the strong sense. A lot of the stuff that you find in the way with Tlatoli requires none of that stuff. So none of the like beliefs in the afterlife, which can't in principle be verified or things like that. When the father tells his son, you know, this is how you need to act in order to be human. His observations are, you know, explicitly like, you're old enough now, you should know how the world works. Like, we have another passage where a father literally tells his daughter that. And one of the criteria for evaluating the worth of the ethical discussion is that you should be able to pull on your common sense as a human being, which is as equally available to them as it is to us. All right. So another one that they'll say is it's in the books of red and black ink, which is a way of saying it's in tradition, but tradition isn't self-certifying. It's just a source of truth or knowledge, right? But that doesn't necessarily pull on like supernatural sources. So there are clearly moments, again, bananas. We can pull them apart. We can peel apart the things. There are other moments that turn less on that, such as their conception in one that, you know, the universe is God, that God is nature and that God is divine or that nature is divine, that sort of thing. Well, I don't know. That's philosophical and theological kind of all wrapped up into the same thing. And you probably can't separate that. But for what it's worth, Spinoza held something pretty similar, and we call him a philosopher.
Were these thinkings and teachings for everyone in the Mesoamerican society, or were they more specifically for a particular class?
There are differences, and a lot of the admonitions actually turn on your social role differentiation. So let me take that two ways. One, a lot of the language and theoretical elaboration would not have been common. Specific people went to school for specific things and learned this stuff, but not every commoner must have dwelt in, like, among the commoners. They wouldn't have known that. So reserve the right to find weird words used in specific ways as philosophers tend to mangle them. Having noted that, Yeah, a lot of the admonitions are specific to people in their roles and your social role obligations are where a lot of the obligations derive for the Nahuas. So although they're virtue ethicists, it's more like you need to be courageous in order to support your social role, or you need to be prudential in order to effectively act in your role. So for example, a simple one that I had with my daughter the other day, my wife usually takes her to the dance. My daughter's three, her little dance class. And I couldn't do it. She couldn't make it. So I picked her up there and I went in. I knew nobody there. Like, I've never met all these people before. So I don't know. It's a prudential consideration to go around and just meet all the relevant people. So I met the dance instructor and blah, blah, blah. So while she's out there doing the stuff, I did that. I connected to all of the other little kids. There was one other dad and most of the other moms, just to kind of know who they are, blah. Learn about your kid. Socialize, do that. Like, that was a prudential consideration. I should know about that, right? But it was in service of my role as a father to my daughter, right? So the virtue enables you to exercise your obligations. And so most of our obligations attach to our social roles, whereas the virtues themselves are things that you kind of need to, you know, cultivate more specifically. So that means that not all advice is the same for all people, because not all people have the same social roles. Some people are fathers and mothers, some are daughters, and that's actually how the wisdom is divided in the way with Tlatoli. It's a kind of dialogue, but it's a dialogue between a father to a son, or a judge to citizens, fully grown adults, right? Or sometimes they'll even have of various city leaders to other city leaders, right? Because it's all social role differentiation. You kind of need different advice depending on where you are in life. And that's how they saw it. And that's why the discourses are broken down almost by individual. One of the things in the discourses of the elders is it almost follows the trajectory of a life. Child is born, kind of grows up, goes through the various ages, goes into being married, and then it goes into like various kind of political obligations that you have as a citizen, sort of thing. Like, that's the organization of the book. And well, and then it ends with a whole bunch of religious catechism, which again, it's just Catholic wrappings in Nahuatl.
And now I'm really kind of curious, what, like, for the era that you're looking at, you've kind of hinted at it a little bit already, but what would the like cosmological or like most basic kind of ontological picture of the world or universe or time look like for the people? I know that's a huge question, but like kind of give us an idea of what that world was for them.
I'll stick to the cosmology insofar as it bears on metaphysics. How about that? Because that's what I feel like I know the best. There's pretty good agreement among scholars that what there is a thing called Teot, or the divine. That's nature. There's disagreement about whether or not Oma Teot is the next thing that happens. But the way I tend to think about the relationship between these two terms, one means divine, the other means dual divine, sort of like being in existence. Being is all possibilities, but it takes concrete form as this and not that, the duality of things, right? And so they have a whole series of what are called inamiquan, which are kind of like relational pairs. Some of these are strange. Some of these are like here versus there, top versus bottom, that stuff. So if you're in this room, you're not in that room. Okay, so the relational pairs to become concrete or to exist is something different from the possibilities of being. So I sort of see that as the relationship there. So, and then I think of their metaphysics and cosmology is increasing scales of determination. So, you know, color becomes more determinate as red, which becomes more determinate as scarlet, etc. So as you kind of go down the chain of metaphysics, you go down the chain of more increasing determination. So existence is a more determinate form of being, and then existence takes shape in its doubles, right, into a cosmological whole, which is called the sun, which is how I read the legends of the sun. Because in those legends, you find that humans existed various times and they ate different things, had different corn or it's just substance that they had. So it's somehow their existence was different. It's almost like there's an existential dimension. Like however the previous humans existed, they were also humans. They lived this world differently, specifically through their interactions with space and time. It sounds like a Heideggerian would say these things, but it's really just kind of how it goes at it, right? That's what differentiates things. And then you kind of get to even more concrete forms, which is, so always what you're trying to do is balance these doubles all the way down. Ultimately, what you're trying to do is, you know, sun, city would be next, kind of like down into your city. And your city is an organization between the buildings and the land over which the people in the buildings were working. It's a double form there, and cities grow almost by like cellular mitosis. You start with one of these, then they divide into two, and they divide into four and eight, right? And that's what a city is. And ultimately, those divisions are neighborhoods. The neighborhoods have obligations. So maybe one neighborhood, they're called kalpoli, one neighborhood would, I don't know, do feather work. Another one would do gold work. Another one would grind up maize. They would rotate those obligations, which are basically like taxes, but they would rotate them in order to maintain unity among the group. And so it's not, and that's the core idea, is that these doubles have some third thing, some idea that organizes them, right? And you'll find this. And that's how their cities grew. So what they called the Aztec Empire was just a conglomerate of a bunch of these things. The leader was the speaker for the most prominent neighborhood, right? And the most prominent neighborhood would be established through mostly feats in battle, just so you know. So the leader was a speaker. And it turns out that Montezuma was nothing but the leader of the most prominent neighborhood of Tenochtitlan, which was the most prominent city of an alliance of three cities. So it's a weird idea, but you can kind of see how this all hangs together. So they thought of things as ordering and arranging by organizing these doubles that don't inherently go together, but that could if you organize them by a word, a tlatole, a reason, almost like logos, right? But not quite. And that organizes these doubles in a harmonic way. And ultimately, as a human being, you have a face and a heart. You have two features of your character. And so your heart is the seat of your desires. Your face is your seat of judgment. Incidentally, it's not your reason. It's your seat of judgment. And the harmonizing principle for that is ethics, right? That's what ethics is. It is the set of reasons that harmonizes your face and heart. And that in order to do that, you need to develop specific qualities of character that we call, you know, justice, prudence, temperance, courage. And if you do that well, you'll be able to exercise your social roles in your society, and you will lead a good life, a rooted life. So that kind of takes you all the way from things that exist, like what is there, down to what are we supposed to do as human beings? We live under a specific cosmological configuration, the fifth sun. Notably, all configurations pass for them. They're a little bit like the Norse culture. And they thought that this one would also pass, which is one of the key ways in which they were ethical pessimists. Not because they thought none of this mattered. Obviously, the value of life then comes in the struggle against impossible odds, because you can realize your best attempts to realize a good life, you know, aren't secured. And that's kind of the view that they had on things. But the cosmology is consistent with that view. You're organizing these doubles that don't inherently go together. And at some point, chaos wins out and it all falls apart. So that can kind of take you the broad scale in. Oh, and notice how, yes, that touches on some cosmology, some things that you could consider religious, but other things that kind of just don't.
The metaphysics peters into the ethics in that very sort of gradual, subtle way. That's sort of its strength, right, is that the ethical component there is quite well integrated into its metaphysical understanding. I can see immediately how social roles play such a central role in that, right? Because when you have obligations within a social role, that obligation is always an obligation to someone, even if it's to yourself, say. So you always have that always have that complex ethical gestalt that you're trying to mediate.
They would be opposed to the idea also like free-floating obligations or something like that. Right? Those aren't. Like, obligations are just spelling out the conditions that you need to observe to do a thing, like be a good friend or be a good human to yourself.